for those looking to live outside the box of religious performance and inside the love of an awesome Father, this is The God Journey. And we're back, and I'm still in Visalia, California with Dave Coleman. Hi, Dave.
Good morning again.
We're still right back-to-back, so I don't know if these will air back-to-back online, but just gave me a chance to talk to you, and which I always love, and thought I'd drag the rest of whoever's listening to this podcast into your house with me, so hope you don't mind the room full of guests we have.
You're welcome.
Even though we can't see them, but if you ever get near Visalia, Dave and Donna spread a pretty good table, so hunt them up.
Give us a ring.
Really?
You betcha.
Man, that's scary. You don't know how many people that could include. It's always strange for me to be back in Visalia. We lived here 15 years and a lot of great memories of this town, a lot of great friends that live here. And there are also some painful moments and some unreconciled relationships in this town. So it's always a bit awkward to be here. But I always, the people I enjoy here, I enjoy a lot. So that's good. And the painful things, you know, that's kind of 15 years ago. So kind of past most of that, I think. Let that lie where it lies.
Oh, yeah.
But you keep living on here where it's 175 degrees outside today and we're already sweating. And, dude, there are cooler places to live. You know this, don't you?
In Melrose Park?
Melrose Park. I don't know where that is.
No.
Newbury Park? Are you making fun
Newbury
of my address? Are you making fun of my address?
No, boy.
Yeah. We don't
on the coast next to Barbara Streisand?
We don't tell people where I live. No, I'm not next to Barbara Streisand, A. B, I'm not on the coast. But gee whiz. Now you've made it something it isn't.
Malibu Beach?
It is. No, we're not on Malibu Beach, but we are. The weather last night was 55 degrees is the low and going to get up to about 72 today, so...
Tough
weather, yeah. But I can't get you to come visit. It's been 3 years I've been begging you to come visit me. Are you ever going to come?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, we will.
When I kill my dogs, is that what it's going to take since you're allergic to the hounds, unfortunately? And if you love Sarah, you're going to love her hounds because Sarah's a hound lover.
I know, that's great.
But we can banish them to the outdoors when you come. And we've got a bedroom they never go in, so you could obviously stay the night with us. Hope you do sometime. You listened to the John Beaumont interview a little bit, did you?
Yes, I did. Both of them. Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fun guy. We had Leah wrote us this. She said, this was absolutely beautiful and resonated with what God has been leading me toward for so many years. This conversation left me with the feeling of a warm blanket on a cool, brisk morning, so comforting as if God himself was holding me close. Well, that's a podcast for you. So if you didn't catch John, you might want to go back and catch John Beaumont. I did a couple of podcasts. Jack Gray a little bit earlier. Did you listen to Jack's? You didn't get a chance to listen to those.
No.
You might want to. Jack, such different guys. Both Kiwis. Well, Jack's actually from Scotland, but he's been in New Zealand long enough to be a Kiwi. Totally different personalities. Both in the twilight years of their life. And I love that two men who've walked with God 60, 70 years, probably longer, come to this point in their life and they're totally different. And you listen to the podcast, you get a feel for that. John's outgoing, man, excited. He's got all kinds of stuff going. Jack's the most gentle, quiet, deep soul. So, you know, Jack's like being in the rapids and John's like being in the rapids. Jack's like being in the cool little pond on the side of the stream. And God makes himself known in both of them, lives that have really taken shape over years. But I did have you because I've had some chance to be with people kind of in the twilight moments of life, talking about some life-ending kinds of things. But Sharon in Australia wrote me this and said, I listened to a couple podcasts with the fellow who wrote So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore with, talking about you. And as a nurse, I have had some very disappointing interactions with hospital chaplains, although this was years ago. I'd love to hear more from him about his work, supporting the grieving, dealing with death, become common experiences for all of us as we get older, and particularly dealing with some of our parents and things. So you were a hospice chaplain how long?
Good 10 years.
Good 10 years, mm-hmm. And you've been retired from that. That was your last real gig, I guess.
Right.
Hospital chaplain. At the time you had a pretty serious bout with cancer. I mean, you kind of got near death's door. Am I right? As I recall it.
Yes. Yeah, I was there.
You were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd be fun. This is going to be the death podcast, so that'll be really fun. I don't think I'm going to listen to the death podcast, but people have, and I've had other people say the same thing. You mentioned some last week where you've been with people coming to death's door, and you find that not often do Christian people come to death's door at peace.
That's true.
Which is surprising, because we're the ones who are supposed to say the better stuff is on the other side of this. But that's not your experience.
No.
Why not?
Well, I can give you many examples, but I would say the whole thing of expectation that, you know, I had done all this for God. I had been on this committee, that committee. I'd been on this missionary trip, that missionary trip. And somehow that has created a sense of God owes me.
Entitlement. Wow.
Yeah. Which is really, you know, a basic issue in our society. I'm entitled. Yeah. And when that...
You get lost on that for the...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know, I've been at the bedsides of dying clergy who were... just totally angry. You know, here I did all of this and now...
What did they expect? A pain-free death?
Yeah, to live...
Just fall asleep one night and not wake up and...
Yeah, there was so much tension in my ministry and so forth, and now I'm free and I want to go on my cruises and so on and so forth.
I'm dying earlier than I want to die.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
And then often death is not pleasant. I mean, these bodies, when they wear out, it's not a lot of fun.
No.
You keep telling me every time I say, don't get old, Wayne, and no matter how much you tell me that, it's not working. I got aches and pains I never used to have and never thought I would have. So,
oh, boy, yeah. I tell you.
So getting old isn't fun. That we know.
No.
That would argue for death's door being maybe a wonderful transition to something better.
Yeah, there's so much feeling of, as I mentioned, this the God owes me type thing. And the other part of it is... what I would call a real fear, a fear of God, because I didn't perform like I was told I should perform.
Part of it was what we talked about last week. You know, you're going to get the video right after you die
right.
of all the crud in your life. And so, they don't die in this, I've got a loving father now who's...
No.
Can you imagine if you're the father coming home to your kids from work during the day? And your kids are afraid to see it, so they all go run and hide under their beds when dad comes home. And I know there are kids that do that because dad's earned that. But you would think God wouldn't want that. Wouldn't God want his kids running to him at that moment?
You would think so.
But
let me share this one story with you, which is one of the most sad stories that I've ever been a party to. There was... a little, dear little old white-haired lady was being taken care of by her daughter. She became a patient of hospice rather late and had only about a week to live is what the doctors told us. So I went to see her and she was lying in bed, beautiful white hair, just, you know, the picture of anybody's grandma. And she was just wreathing in pain from side to side, back and forth. And I tried to speak with her, and she wouldn't say anything.
Wow.
But what she did say, she kept saying, "Tie, tie, tie." And so I went out and I talked to her daughter. I said, "I don't know if she's trying to talk to me. Do you know what she's saying?" And she said, "Yeah." She said, when we were young, there were three of us, three daughters, and our father was one of the first in the Second World War, and he was killed early in the war. And those were the days before insurance. And she said, in order to keep things going, I know my mother had to work almost constantly, two and three jobs. And she said, I know there were many times she fed us when there wasn't even enough for her to eat. But we attended a church which said that, you know, if you don't tithe, you're going to hell.
You're robbing from God.
You're robbing from God.
Yeah.
And those were the days.
But you don't believe, by the way, do you?
Oh, no.
Okay, good. But
no,
it's been taught.
And the girl said those, she didn't, her choice was to feed her starving children or tithe. And She didn't, and that has hung over her all of her life.
Wow.
We have talked with her. We have sent clergymen to speak with her, but here she is in really spiritual agony. And I spoke with the nurse on duty, and I said, is there anything we can do for her? And the nurse said, Dave, we've given her all the painkillers that we possibly can. And she died in complete agony because of this fear of God that had been created, because she didn't do what she was supposed to do.
Here's the one thing from her life 50 years ago that was going to make God mad at her at the end of it all. Wow.
And that's sad. And that's how entrenched this performance stuff can be, you know, which will cause you your agony. In fact, in hospice, when we would get the opening sheet where the nurse would do the intake and ask questions like, what religion do you follow or do you belong to? I was happy when there was no religion. Because here I could go in and talk about the love of a God who really loves them without any conditions. I've had situations where I've gone into a religious home and they wouldn't even let me see the patient because the patient was mad at the church, a pastor, an elder, or whatever.
Wow. Well, that's easy to understand, that part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And so when you see God, not as this enduring presence you're going to meet, but the God who's disappointed in you or angry in you, or that's where that performance, that's why forgiveness is such a important reality for us, that things are really washed away in the reality of what Christ did for us. And God's not judging us based on performance. And
no.
What did you find going on in your heart? You've been with a lot of people at death's door. What did you find going on in your heart when you thought you were getting there? You may be getting there sooner than you wanted. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, I do. It was a...
Did you feel like you were at peace, or were you...
It was kind of interesting. The operation I went through for colon cancer was pretty severe because they took everything out, looked at it, and put it back to make sure there was no cancer that had spread, that they couldn't cut off and go from there.
Yeah, wow.
So... So what had happened was they got the orders mixed up and they fed me. And you can't really feed someone after a colon cancer operation, at least for 4 or 5 or 6 days.
Wow.
For everything to gel and so on and so forth.
Yep.
But before the operation, you don't eat either so that you're totally cleaned out. So anyway, the nurse had brought in a tray of food shortly after the operation and when I came around, which I simply devoured without even, no one had told us
and
so forth. So three days after that, in the middle of the night, I started to vomit, and then it went into, you know, dry heavings, and then I went...
I have a weak stomach, Dave, so be careful.
Yeah, well, anyway, then I went into convulsions, and I knew then that this was going to be it, because I knew, you know, the operation was quite lengthy, and you know, you're cut from top to bottom, so to speak. So I knew that I would bust all the stitches at that early stage.
Hmm.
And so I called for the nurse and I said, I'm convulsing. I said, I need a shot of morphine. I said, to calm down my body. And she said, I can't do it without doctor's orders. And then that was the final word. That I knew that was it, you know, that this was my time. But the interesting thing was that I just kind of said, you know, well, Lord, it looks like I'm coming. And there was a strange peace that just came over me. And I just, you know, was lying there. The whole body was just, you know, in contortion, so to speak. And it was, you know, I don't know what kind of a, you know, people talk about near-death experience and all this sort of stuff. And I was there, and the last thing I remember just shortly before, and I, you know, forced myself not to pass out, and just before that, the nurse came in with a with a vial filled with morphine with the needle about 6 inches long.
Oh.
And I said, go for it. And that's how it ended. But right before then.
You couldn't put it in your drip. I'd say go for the drip, man. Don't.
No, there wasn't time for the drip.
Oh, man, had a 6-inch needle. I would prefer to die, I think, than be poked with a 6-inch needle.
Well, I hope you never have to make that choice.
That's what my dad said. My dad had this surgery botched thing on a gallbladder surgery about 3 or 4 years ago, and he had to be transferred to University of San Francisco Hospital, and they had made some mistakes up there, and he was really close to dying, very close.
Yeah.
And we thought he was.
Mm-hmm.
And after he recovered, and boy, things turned around pretty quickly there, finally. And I looked at him, I said, were you afraid of dying? And he said, no, I was afraid I wouldn't die. I was in so much pain, I was afraid to live. That's what he said.
Yeah, that's honest. It really is, because you can get to that point.
But no fear of what death might be for you. I mean, you look at it now, you're much – I mean, I chose the most decrepit person I could think of for this podcast.
Thank you.
No, no problem. Even when you heard the C word for the first time, the cancer diagnosis, what are your thoughts about mortality? How has that changed you? Does that – feed into how you live daily? Do you live differently with a sense of mortality? Or
yeah, you do, because once you face it and you go through it, then life changes. Your whole value system changes. You see things entirely different. You begin seeing things from the point of view of who are people, and people are not to use, they're to be loved. People are, you know, if they're not God's children, they're potentially God's children in the talking in the biblical sense of the word.
Yep.
And you look at it that way. Do I still get irritated with people now and then? Oh yeah, some guy pulls out in front of me and that kind of thing. But you live your life without fear. And you're able to say, okay, I don't have to react to that. I can just kind of respond to that. And that's a growing process. But it was, for me, a complete turn. And where you just say, hey, this thing, you're not in control of this thing.
Is it less about achievements and
things
on your resume? Is it less about that and more about the people you love and know and the relationships you value? And
that's all over with. Huh. Yeah, you don't think about what, you know.
Because people look at my life oftentimes, and I've published some books, and you know, I've made some waves in the world, and you know, people think that's successful. I look at your life and, you know, a defrocked pastor, wallpaper hanger for a while, hospice chaplain in a small community. I look at your life and I see tremendous fullness, a sense of success without all the trappings. And I mean success at a level that matters.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the success of my life externally, and I know how much that stuff doesn't matter, but people don't.
Right.
I mean, what's going on between Sarah and me right now is the most valuable thing in my life. And I would give up everything else. I feel like God's asked me to say some things in the world. So I do things, to podcast and whatever, to say some things into the world. But that's not where my life finds great value or joy. I'm just as happy being home with Sarah or having the grandkids over. Or like we had these friends from Ireland last weekend. I'm much more. It's the simple realities of life that have the most meaning. It's not that you've done a best-selling book. It's not
right.
People know. People recognize you or invite you to come speak. And I think that. I mean, I look at your life as incredibly successful, but I think other people could look at it going, "Wow, he never did anything huge," even though you were co-writer on the book with me. But. And I love that. I mean, I think that's a better model for success than what we hold up in the celebrities and performers and people in the world that, you know, catch the eye of the public. But not too many people get opportunities for those things. If you measure success that way, you're going to get pretty weary. How do you measure it?
I think success is, can and should be measured only on a relational value. How do I feel about God? How does God feel about me? how can I work in the lives of people around me to lessen their fear, their anger, their apprehension. When I look at the life of Jesus, he was always putting people at ease. Neither do I condemn you.
Yep.
And to me, that's what success is. How do I relate to God and how do I relate to people?
You said that to me one time. The measure of success of a man is how he treats his wife. You said that to me once.
Yeah.
You really believe that stuff?
I do believe it.
That's good.
Yeah. And when I was in the church, I even, you know, I would not allow an elder to be, well, not allow, but I would not put up an elder for nomination unless I really looked at his relationship with his wife.
Hmm.
Because that, to me, that's where it's at.
Has some of that changed? And we're talking about, you know, when you have a sense of mortality. Did you have at a younger ages more of this aspiring desire to achieve, and this has been a change over time in your life, or as you've always kind of been in this?
No, it's been a change.
Okay.
Yeah, as you work out of the performance thing and just relax with who you are in God's eyes, then all this stuff leaves.
I want to share some stuff with you from a book that someone sent me recently, and I didn't really want to read this book because it's a near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a near-death experience of an atheist, interestingly enough. And I don't know if you heard Steve Jobs when he passed away, the Apple mogul, and he was a pain in the neck to everybody around who worked for him. He wasn't a godly man by any stretch of anything. His last words when he died, he was coming right to the death's door, and he kind of looked up from his bed, and he said, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow," and then he died, which is just, what does that mean? You know, no one knows for sure what it means, obviously, but I thought that's intriguing. I'm not a fan of near-death experience books because I'm not sure what they are. Most of what I read just kind of panders to a Christian worldview that I don't find deeply settling in terms of how I know God, so I don't like books like this. But this was one that was written by an atheist, and his experiences I found fascinating, not because of it's a near-death experience, but I'm thinking, wow, that's how I have engaged God inside this world. I've not had a near-death experience, but what rings with authenticity is I think this is what God's like. I really do. And then he goes on to a bunch of theology. The book is called My Descent into Death by Howard Storm. He was an artist of some note and a sculptor and a well-known atheist. And I mean, he had all that. And then he had some kind of tear in his intestinal system happened to him in Europe. And he died or almost died on a table, operating table. And I'm just going to read a couple excerpts early because I think this is the better part of the book, to be honest. I think we get to the other, he kind of waxes eloquent on his theology now about God, and some of that I didn't sync with. But when he dies, when he thinks he dies on this table, he's drugged off by a bunch of demonic-like personalities that are just biting and devouring him. And he wrote this, "I was alone in the darkness for time without measure. I thought about what I had done. All my life I had thought about hard work was what counted. My life was devoted to building a monument to my own ego, my family, my sculptures, my painting, my house, my gardens, my little fame, my illusion of power were all extensions of my ego. All of those things were gone now, and what did they matter? All those things that I had lived for were lost to me, and they didn't mean a thing. All of my adult life, I had been strong and confident that I could take care of myself. Now I was a worm cast into the outer darkness and had neither any strength nor power nor my inner rage to protect me." Interesting, this inner rage to protect him. Interesting comment. "The ordeal had stripped me of all my defense. All of my life, I'd fought a constant undertone of anxiety, fear, dread, and angst. If I could become famous, I could defeat powerlessness and beat death." That's an interesting statement. But if I didn't become famous, then I'd die and my whole life would be meaningless. So I didn't live in the present. I had always striven for an unattainable eternal flame as my protection against oblivion. How ironic it was to end up in the sewer of the universe with people who fed off the pain of others. I had had little genuine compassion for others, and it dawned on me that I was not unlike these miserable creatures who had tormented me. Failing truly to love, they had been led into the outer darkness where their only desire was to inflict their inner torment onto another. Devoid of love, hope, and faith, they craved intimacy, but found it only to be a torment." That, now, that was his experience.
Mm-hmm.
which I just, if you want to describe hell or whatever, I don't think you get to a better description.
No.
And I love that sense of all the things you think are going to cheat death and all the things that people seek, fame and power and, you know, have things that are extensions of their own ego, their art, their whatever. And I read through this going, man, I've lived some of this. I've lived in environments where people who crave intimacy are just destroying each other out of their own projection of their own needs. So I don't know that this is hell and demons. I think it's just life without God. With
it
people.
Is, yeah.
And then he called in the middle of this, and this is what's, I know it's going to stretch people who feel like, well, you were an atheist when you died, so tough bananas, but he didn't really die. He came back to life, so we don't know, and he became a believer afterwards. Because in the middle of these creatures and this darkness and this devoid of hope and life, he hears this voice saying, call me, call me, call me. And he knew it was Jesus, but he didn't believe in Jesus. And so he has this inner, this wonderful little bit of this inner turmoil. I'm going to call out to someone I don't believe in. But he was so terrified, so scared, he calls out. And then this is what happens. And I love this too. I love this description. He says, this loving, luminous being came to him. And he embraced him. And he said, this loving, luminous being who embraced me, knew me intimately. He knew me better than I knew myself. He was knowledge and wisdom. I knew that he knew everything about me, and I was unconditionally loved and accepted. I experienced love in such intensity that nothing I had ever known before was comparable. His love was greater than all human love put together. His love totally enveloped me, and I realized that he had substance. He was indescribably wonderful. Goodness, power, knowledge, and love. He was more loving than one can begin to imagine or describe, and Jesus did indeed love me. This person of blinding glory loved me with overwhelming power. After what I had been through, to be completely known and accepted and intensely loved by this incredible God-man of light surpassed everything I had ever known or could possibly imagine. I'd called out to Jesus and he came to rescue me. I cried and cried from joy and the tears kept coming. Joy upon joy billowed through me. He held me and caressed me like a mother with her baby, like a father with his long-lost prodigal son. I cried all the tears of a lifetime of hopelessness and tears of shame over my unbelief. I cried all the joys of the tears of joy and salvation. I cried like a baby that couldn't stop crying. I was permeated with tangible, intense feelings and thoughts of love. While moving toward the presence of great light, the center of all being, the one, I was beyond thought. It is not possible to articulate what occurred. Simply, I knew that God loved me, that God loved his creation, that God is love itself. This experience of love totally changed my life from the inside out. No matter what happened, I would always know that God loved me.
That's it.
Isn't that something?
That's fantastic, yeah.
Oh. And see, I don't know the death thing and near death and whether he died and God saved him after death. And
yeah.
I'm not even interested in that. He makes some arguments going on in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But what he describes about the darkness of inner torment, I've known that. That gonna try to reach some level of success to hide from my own sense of powerlessness and fear, mm-hmm. insecurity. And then come to engage one that you know loves you more than anyone ever has or will, who is all good and wonderful and loves you without any expectation or demand that you be different than you are.
Right.
And yet that makes you different. Like I said, nothing can ever be the same after that moment. I mean, that mm-hmm. actually changes who you are. Any thoughts about, I mean, I've hesitated to recommend this book because there's a lot of theology in it I wouldn't embrace. But those two descriptions of the pain of selfishness, the emptiness, the thirst for intimacy and only find destruction, and then finding this complete affection in the Father. And then it really he came out of this experience a believer. He lived his life very differently. And I just, it's incredible.
It is incredible.
Because that's the God I know. What he describes in those four paragraphs about Jesus grabbing mm-hmm. him and meeting him, that's the God I know and love.
And that's the God Paul knew, too, when they asked him at Thessalonica, you know, when's he coming back? When are all these things going to happen? And he says, you have no need to know this stuff. But what you need to know is, so shall we ever be with the Lord.
Mm.
The relationship continues.
Mm.
And to me, that's That's it. That's the answer.
Yeah.
When it happens, how it happens, you know, people talk about, well, we got to fear this date or that date. No, all we do is look forward to the time when we shall have a closer, more intimate relationship with Him.
Yeah.
And that's it.
That whole 1 John 3, then we'll behold Him face to face and known by Him, or know Him as well as He knows us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That'll be a moment.
Yeah.
I thought of that when a good friend of ours passed away about 5 years ago. He had cancer at 55, mm-hmm. died fairly young. And I was at his deathbed when he passed away, and I just looked up at his now new widow, and I said, I wish I knew what Paul knows right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I think about death.
Right.
When it's gone here, your eye opens to something that has got to be, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, to know... Scripture talks so much about this being a shadow of a bigger reality, of our life on this earth being but a dew that's on the grass in the morning. And if you're in the Central Valley here, the dew lasts about 30 seconds on the grass before it's gone as the heat of the day heats up. But I think there's great wisdom in seeing our life here that way. And I think people who struggle with death, they just see life on this planet as everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's over... Even Christians, it's like, this is the best thing, and now eternity. And if you don't see your life here as like being a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, we hardly remember what it was when we were 2 or 3.
Good point.
And I think that's how God sees this life, but we don't. We think if we don't achieve, if we don't get to a certain place in this life, if we don't, then our life is wasted. Or if someone dies young, oh, what a waste of a person because they died young. Instead of, you know what, this was only the antechamber of the greater reality. This is the lobby. This is the out front stuff. And that's how I think of death. And I'm not looking forward to it in the sense that I would miss my kids and grandkids, undoubtedly. I don't know that I would miss them. I hope they would miss me if I wasn't here. But I'm sure in God's eternity of things, they're going to be along shortly in that whole sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's got to be such a wonder to that next moment after you take your last breath.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that we... need to be afraid of.
Well, I like the word transition rather than death.
Yeah. It's transitioning to a different reality, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
To a better reality.
Yeah.
And that's what I think of now. I mean, I got aches and pains. I'm still young. I'm only 59. But we're not guaranteed nothing. We don't know how long this goes. And, you know, I've had some scary stuff in the last couple of years, some medical things that turned out not to be much, but they were looking for some very serious things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made me rethink it. And I find that through this whole learning to live loved and knowing this kind of God that Howard Storm describes meeting in this quasi-death experience that he had, I find that takes all the sting out of whatever it is that death is. I mean, I look forward to the process of it because it usually is kind of ugly and painful and all that. And there's people around you that love you that are going to be all teary-eyed and all that good stuff. But death itself is a transition into, I don't know, but it's enough to know He's there. He's the
right
one.
Yeah, His presence, yeah.
Yeah. Anything more about that? I read you a lot of stuff, but...
When we were chatting last night, you mentioned that this whole thing about age and that you're just not really that concerned about the future, and you said something to the effect that you have already produced your best stuff. And I had this...
Don't tell God that, though. I don't want God to know.
No, I had to smile at that because... You have reached the point where you don't feel you have to write 10,000 books, the sequel to this, the sequel to that, and so forth.
I don't.
And I smiled because now what you will do will be so much better.
Hmm.
Because you're, it's over as far as who... am I trying to be, or what do I have to accomplish, and so on and so forth. And I can't wait to see your next book or your next writing.
No,
I'm serious, because you're totally at peace.
Yeah, but it's funny, because when I was so driven by my insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
They motivated me to write, to travel, to work hard, to do all that stuff.
Right.
As God's been unwinding that in the last 15 years, and those motivations go away, and some of them have been gone for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting now that I find it easier to enjoy the day and less pressed to get to work.
So that's it.
Then you do less in some way. Yeah. I actually write less. I feel less motivated to, you know, get a blog up every day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even try. I haven't tried in quite a while. But I do enjoy the things that I get to share. They're things I just really want to share because they've been meaningful to me.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what that's going to look like if we... I mean, the Jesus lens was all part of that. I didn't feel like I had to do it. I didn't feel like I had to get this out. This is the, you know, crowning achievement of my life or anything. I just wanted to help people understand Scripture in a way that might be helpful to them.
Yeah, and that's the goal. That's the purpose. Just helping folks on the journey.
It sure is different waking up in the morning without the weight of trying to be something.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
It really is.
Remember all the seminars we went to about setting goals and use of your time, et cetera, et cetera.
And all the competition, because if you're going to be significant, that means you've got to be more significant than people around you. So you're always competing. It's always it's always been competition.
Pastoral conferences.
Yeah.
Well, I got 3,000 new members. Well, I only got 3.
Well, writers are no better. Writers are no better with how many books are you selling and what's your last advance and, you know, all the crud of the industry that really is based on someone's ego, not simply finding stuff that's valuable to put in the hands of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't even know if I will write again. I've got 9 books on my head and heart. And I look at them going, you know, if it's ever going to happen, it's going to be because God says, why don't you put this together? Because for me, I've said what I've wanted to say in the world. And there may be more to say at some point, but I've said the best stuff. And now I really want to enjoy Sarah and the kids and life and the people we live near in Thousand Oaks and enjoy people like you. We're good friends. So thanks for helping me on a couple of podcasts here.
Oh, it's been delightful. Thank you.
Much appreciated, my friend.
So good to see you again.
You too.
Yeah.
We'll have to do it again. You love, come see me sometime?
Will do.
You will?
I love to see
you. I've got it on tape now, so. Okay.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com,